Today, how a decades-long political divide spilled over into all-out war in northern Ethiopia.
Peace is a labor of love. Sustaining peace is hard work, yet we must cherish and nurture it.
This is a speech made last year by the Prime Minister of Ethiopia. Abiy Ahmed was accepting the Nobel Peace Prize for ending a military standoff between his country and Eritrea that had lasted for decades. At the time, he was hailed as a great reformer and compared to Nelson Mandela.
Thank you very much.
But talk of peace is far behind him now. For the past few weeks, Abiy's government forces have been fighting regional troops in the northern Tigray region in a bloody offensive that has led to casualties and forced tens of thousands of Ethiopians to flee from their homes.
They're killing us in Tigray. There were people being killed, our own children.
After his troops took the Tigrayan capital this weekend, Abiy has declared victory. But it is not clear how this conflict will end and what implications it will have for Ethiopia or its neighbours. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how Ethiopia's Nobel Peace Prize-winning Prime Minister ended up at war in his own country. Jason Burke, you're in Johannesburg, where you're the Africa correspondent for The Guardian. And I think we should start by talking about the man at the centre of this story, the Ethiopian Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed. What kind of leader is he?
I was in Addis Ababa a few months before he took power in 2018. And it was a very grim atmosphere. Nobody really had much in the way of hope for the future. There were lots of very obvious economic, social and political problems. And Abiy came in 42 years old at that point, pretty unknown, charismatic, modern in the way he spoke. He promoted lots of women in the cabinet. He did lots of things that made a lot of people feel that Ethiopia was entering a new era, a brighter era, after decades of repressive government. For the first year, it really did seem that Abiy could do no wrong. He was popular. He was getting stuff done. He won the Nobel Peace Prize. Abiy appeared to be delivering all the things that investors, donors, foreign governments wanted, and that many of his own people wanted. That feeling lasted for probably about a year, and then things really began to go sour.
What were the circumstances within which he was able to become Prime Minister?
Abiy came in to solve two problems, one inside government and one outside government. The problem inside government was that the multi-ethnic coalition that had been running Ethiopia for a very long time, dominated by people from Tigray, the northern region, but including others, was beginning to fall apart.
The United Nations is demanding Ethiopia allows international observers to parts of the country. At least 90 demonstrators were killed during a wave of anti-government protests.
There was clearly a need for some kind of rebalancing away from what had been the effective dominance of the Tigrayans for nearly 30 years. Now, Abiy is Oromo and Amhara in terms of his background, two of the major constituencies that felt left out.
After weeks of intense deliberations, Ethiopia's ruling People's Revolutionary Democratic Front has finally chosen a new chairman. Abiy Ahmed won 60% of the votes in parliament to become the first prime minister of Oromo descent.
Bringing Abiy in to lead the coalition meant that it had a new look. It looked more balanced, it looked more representative. That, it was hoped, would allow the coalition to stay in power and allow a solution to be found for all the various deep and pressing problems within Ethiopia, some of which were due to inter-ethnic tensions, others were simply deep structural economic problems, regional problems, security issues, and all the other challenges that developing states face.
Yanis Wolde-Mariam, you grew up in Ethiopia and you now watch what happens in the country from Seattle as an academic specialising in the Horn of Africa. In the West, we unfortunately, I think, often only talk about Ethiopia in terms of tragedy, whether it's war or famine. But what is it like as a country?
Oh, it's a beautiful country, northern Ethiopia, has many rugged mountains.
Haile Selassie's Empire of Ethiopia is easily the most mountainous country in all Africa. It's rather like a fortress of rock set in a sea of sand.
And southern Ethiopia is tropical forest, very green. It's a very diverse country. There are over 80 ethnic groups.
Wow.
Ethiopia is the first to embrace all Judaism, Christianity, and Islam in Africa, home to the earliest Christian church in Africa. And it was the same Ethiopia that Islam made its way even before the Muslims' flight to the city of Medina from Mecca.
And it was centralized during the time of Menelik II, who ruled from 1889 to 1913. As the Europeans were colonizing, he was also doing his own colonizing. And for that reason, you find a very sharp divide between people in terms of how they remember history. In terms of its significance to international politics, as far as U.S. foreign policy is concerned, it was considered to be a kind of an anchor for the Horn of Africa.
What did you think when Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018?
The fanfare was unbelievable. It was almost like the second coming of the Messiah, literally. The personality cult that was building around Abiy was, in my view, very undeserved. I mean, any cult is undeserved, but people were projecting, in my view. And so, in that sense, I felt that the Ethiopian people were setting themselves up for a disappointment, honestly. He was an intelligence officer. As a matter of fact, the chief of INSA, the intelligence organization in Ethiopia. And in that, don't become a nice guy and become an intelligence officer. I mean, what did he do when he was an intelligence officer? I mean, it's not just because it's Abiy. The Ethiopian situation is very intractable in a lot of ways. Many expectations, many hopes. And so regardless of who comes to power, Ethiopia is a very difficult place to... I wouldn't envy anyone who runs Ethiopia.
Jason, despite being celebrated as a peacemaker in his first year, Abiy's government is now fighting the TPLF, who are from the Tigray region in the north, and who, as you say, used to run the country. Tell us more about them.
The Tigray People's Liberation Front was formed in 1975 by a group of about a dozen students who were calling for revolution and liberation. This was about a year after the emperor, Haile Selassie, had been deposed by Marxist hardliners. The TPLF were very strongly left-wing themselves, but also nationalists who had a very strong sense of the culture, the place, the values, as they saw it, of Tigray, which is northwestern province of Ethiopia, mountainous highlands, deeply historical and cultural place.
Relics of the old imperial civilizations are to be found in the north of the country, where early immigrants from northern parts built up a strong and flourishing empire. These immigrants are looked on as the founders of Ethiopia. Their capital was Aksum, which is still venerated today as a holy place.
And the TPLF set out to fight the Marxist regime in Addis Ababa for autonomy and greater protection of what they saw as their own culture and status. And it was a really brutal battle. It lasted 16 years, and the communist regime in Addis Ababa eventually lost.
We turn now to the African nation of Ethiopia, to the question of whether there is any relief from its twin burdens of famine and civil war following the departure yesterday of President Mengistu Haile Mariam.
And in 1991, at the head of a coalition of other ethnic insurgent groups. The TPLF seized Addis Ababa, deposed the regime, and its leader became the leader of Ethiopia. And the TPLF were careful to form a coalition government, but that ruling coalition was really dominated by the Tigrayans, and it remained dominant until pretty much Abiy Ahmed took power in 2018.
Okay, so Abiy came in after years of TPLF leadership then. What changes did he make when he became prime minister?
You can see that the reforms that he chose to pursue did two things. They did solve some very serious problems, or work towards solving those problems. He released lots of political prisoners, he opened up media space, he started to privatise very cumbersome and wasteful state-owned enterprises, rebalancing the ethnic distribution of senior posts, that kind of thing. And of course, peace with Eritrea. Now, all of those things are useful in and of themselves. But what they also did was chip away steadily at the dominance that the Tigrayan faction within the ruling coalition had established over the previous 30 years. So, for example, the first thing he did when he came in was fire a whole load of senior security officials, including the head of the much feared internal security agency. He's put a whole load of generals on corruption charges, most of whom are Tigrayan. And TPLF are now feeling pretty marginalised, pretty demoralised, and pretty angry. And what we saw over the summer was a series of mini crises that snowballed into a much bigger crisis and eventually into open hostilities.
Aside from the tensions that Abiy has with the TPLF, more widely in Ethiopia, has he been popular?
There are a lot of people who are very unhappy. There's been massive protests, some put down very violently over the summer.
In Ethiopia, police say 62 people and 5 policemen have been killed in 2 days of protests against Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed.
There are a lot of people who are worried that he wants to impose central authority on the regions in a brutal and repressive way that is not respectful of the rights guaranteed to the regions by the constitution. But then there are a lot of supporters as well who will say that he is trying to develop a new non-ethnic Ethiopian national identity. He is trying to maintain the rule of law. He's trying to uphold the constitution, and he's trying to solve the many problems that Ethiopia has. So you're talking about a very polarized country at the moment.
Why has this crisis in Tigray come to a head now?
So over the summer, there were a series of events that took tensions to a much more dangerous place. One was the cancellation of national elections because of COVID. But the Tigrayans were very unhappy about this and decided they were going to have their own elections, which they did in September, but that were declared illegal.
Ethiopia's northern Tigray region will head to the polls on Wednesday in defiance of the federal government. This is seen as the latest challenge to Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed from a slew of regional leaders flexing their muscles ahead
of... But some Tigrayan voters say they were being deprived of their democratic rights.
I believe it is lawful to hold elections every 5 years. It is in the law. It is very important because it means being governed by a legitimate government elected by the people.
How did Abiy's government respond?
Abiy and the government saw the decision of the TPLF to hold local elections as a direct challenge to their authority as the national government. And that sets us up for a lot of escalating rhetoric. And then at the beginning of November, what the government say is a raid by TPLF fighters on national federal troops in a base in Tigray, in which a number of national army officers are killed and a whole load of military hardware looted. And that is the trigger that starts the offensive of federal troops into Tigray.
There are reports that heavy fighting has broken out in the northern state of Tigray, where the government says local forces attacked federal troops in the city of Mekele.
The TPLF deny that any such raid took place and say the story has been concocted as an excuse for war.
They have decided to go to war and we should all prepare for it. There is no reason for this. This is the action of a self-loving government that is trying to resolve political differences through force, weapons and war.
Because none of us can get in there, no journalists, we can't really confirm it either way. But it does look that there was some kind of raid by the TPLF and that was deemed to have crossed a red line by Abiy, who then sent the troops in.
The fugitives within the TPLF have been determined to trigger an armed conflict. No federation and constitutional order can tolerate such illegality. The Ethiopian people have paid a big price thus far for the criminality of belligerent cliques. Now, we all deserve peace and stability. And this operation aims to end the impunity that has prevailed for years.
Jason, as you've mentioned, you're not in Ethiopia right now, and it's actually very difficult to know what's happening in Tigray as there's been a virtual communications blackout in the region. But what can we say about what's been happening in the past few weeks there?
Well, it has been incredibly difficult to get solid information, but you can get a decent idea of what's happening by patching together fragmentary bits of information coming from good sources. The Ethiopian army pushed up three different lines of advance, and the strategy seems to have just been to go direct for Mekele, the capital, to move very fast, to not stop to secure the population. They've also been deploying some air power with airstrikes across the region. TPLF resistance is very difficult to gauge. The TPLF have made some pretty lurid claims of destroying entire Ethiopian national units and inflicting thousands of casualties and destroying dozens or more armoured vehicles and tanks. That appears to me to be exaggerated, but there are pretty good reports of some fairly tough resistance in some places and some pretty heavy casualties on both sides. Again, we don't know what those casualty figures are, but we can say that the casualties among troops and, of course, among civilians have certainly been in the high hundreds, possibly well into the thousands. The final phase of the campaign came pretty quickly.
Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has ordered the military to launch its final offensive against rebel leaders in the northern region of Tigray.
TPLF resistance appeared to collapse around the 23rd, 4th of November, and the Ethiopian forces were around Mekele, just about in heavy artillery range, by the time a 72-hour ceasefire that Abiy had given the TPLF to surrender had expired. There was then a pause of a couple of days, and then very rapidly, Ethiopian forces moved into Mekele that the TPLF appeared to have withdrawn from in terms of their fighting forces. Certainly the civilian inhabitants, about 500,000 of them, largely remained.
You mentioned that there have been casualties, Jason. Are these people that have been caught up in the fighting or are civilians being targeted?
It's very difficult to say how many civilians have been killed or injured. We know there have been a lot. So reports from one big hospital in Mekele suggest that there are hundreds of people being treated in the city for trauma injuries, which are very likely to have been caused by combat. The bulk of them are civilians. Quite whose munitions have caused the damage is, again, almost impossible to say. There are reports, some pretty well substantiated, of atrocities, most notably a massacre of 600, maybe even 700 labourers from a nearby province, Amhara, who were killed early on in the conflict, possibly, probably, by Tigray militia.
Witnesses say the victims were hacked or stabbed to death.
Most are believed to be ethnic Amharas, a region with a long history of tensions with Tigray.
And naturally, there has been a significant amount of displacement as many thousands of people have tried to flee the fighting.
I was actually in the region last week, almost all of last week.
Abdullah Fadil works for UNICEF in Sudan and has been speaking to some of the thousands of Ethiopians who have crossed the border to escape the fighting.
Initially, it took us about 72 hours to arrive because the border where refugees are crossing is quite remote. Everyone has to cross by river, mostly small boats, sometimes even motor boats, others actually crossing through.
How many people are making this journey?
The height of the refugees entering Sudan was almost 6,000 to 7,000 a day.
Gosh.
So far, we have over 42,000, 43,000 refugees who have arrived in just the past 2 weeks, if you can imagine. Some people have crossed with their own herds, sheep, their harvest. Really? Actually, even we saw some tractors. Some people came with their donkeys. We saw motorcycles, doctors, bankers. A lot of young people crossed. And most people looked quite well. They seemed well fed. They were tired. They've walked for hours and sometimes days. Of course, the negative side was people who were really traumatized, who had all of a sudden to leave their country.
At night, armed men came to my house and threatened us and told us we should leave immediately or we will be killed. So I took my two children and what I could carry.
Leaving behind loved ones. In some cases have witnessed or heard the shelling, the fighting, the airplanes dropping bombs, people who were distraught, who were traumatized, who were afraid, people who were talking about being targeted.
This genocide, as to me, this genocide to destroy from Tigray.
Like any other war, you know, you could see the shock of the civilian population that was completely uprooted for no fault of their own. I also met an older gentleman. He had tears in his eyes because, you know, he said, at this age in my life, I don't want to be displaced. And again, war for what? That was really painful to see an elderly gentleman who yet again gets displaced.
When people get across the border, where do they go?
Initially, the Sudanese families at the other side of the border received these refugees, opened their doors, sheltered them, provided them with food. About 6,000 were moved to a new camp close to Gadarib city, called Umrakuba. Interestingly enough, Umrakuba used to be a refugee camp from the 80s set up for Ethiopians who actually crossed to Gadarif, and it was closed. So now it was reopened to move the refugees from closer to the border to Umrakuba.
I went to Humaira to give birth to my child, but then the fighting started and we had to flee. I gave birth to my child while I was running away to come here. He was born on the road. Now I'm back to the camp where I was born as a refugee, and my newborn is at the same camp, also a refugee.
What will happen to these people now?
One thing is what we hope. The other thing is what has happened in almost every refugee crisis we've dealt with over the past decades. What we hope is that the fighting in Ethiopia stops quite quickly and people can go back to their homes and actually be welcomed. We hope that children will be able to go back to school. Almost 45% of the new arrivals are under the age of 18. But what we know is that the average refugee, when they cross international borders, stays out at least 17 years. We still have refugees from Ethiopia and Eritrea in the same areas close to this from the 90s and the 80s.
And what are the conditions like that these people are living in the camp that you described?
Actually, it's desperate. I mean, it's in some places, people are literally outside under the elements. Some were using their own clothes, you know, this long sari type, and putting them under a tree and just trying to create a shade. But more and more, we were providing them with plastic sheeting and so forth and so on. So more and more people were able to build at least some sort of smaller shelters. All in all, it's really not adequate and not sufficient, and actually it's quite worrying.
Coming up, the Tigrayan capital has been captured, but does this mean an end to the fighting? Jason, we've just heard about the thousands of people who are fleeing northern Ethiopia. How is Abiy's government justifying this offensive in Tigray?
Abiy himself and his officials say very clearly that they are fighting a criminal clique who have flouted the law and the constitution of Ethiopia and need to be brought to justice. They call the offensive a law enforcement operation. As such, they say there is no justification for any overseas intervention, although they thank the international community politely for their concern. And they appear convinced that the unity of Ethiopia is at stake and that they need to defend that unity against what they see as a traitorous band of renegades. As such, it's difficult to see how they can negotiate without being seen to back down. And so far, they've refused to become involved in any kind of mediation because they say that would be to recognise and to legitimise the TPLF.
Johannes, are you worried that events of the last few weeks could lead to widespread ethnic violence?
Those conditions that existed prior to the genocide situation, and I don't use this word very lightly, in Rwanda are there, and especially right now, you know, there is not really much appetite for intervention from other countries. This is an African country. It's not Yugoslavia. And so in that sense, people might just let this thing go much further than it's going. And now, you know, this whole idea of attempting to try to do some kind of a surgical operation to try to get the leaders, it just seems like if it wasn't real, I wouldn't have believed it. That such a thing would happen in Tigray, I wouldn't have believed it. But it's happening as we speak. And it's a very scary situation. Very, very scary situation.
I mean, Abiy has said he won't stop until the TPLF have surrendered. But how likely do you think that is?
The way Abiy is talking about it, like it's a short operation. I don't see this as a short operation. This is going to be very protracted. The Tigrayans won the war against the military government when they were ragtag kind of guerrillas in the late 70s and throughout the 1980s. Now, manpower-wise, they are probably going to be greatly outnumbered. But, you know, they have that tradition. And so I never thought somebody would be crazy enough to invade Tigray. Abiy controlling Mekelle or cities here and there, entering these places does not mean controlling those places. It would be an occupying army. And an occupying army is a sitting duck for a population that feels very resentful and is very experienced in hit-and-run guerrilla-type tactics. And so even if there are setbacks for the TPLF militarily, as it appears now, we haven't seen the end of the story yet. You know, he thinks that he's going to grab these TPLF leaders and it will solve his problem. That's very naive, very, very naive. Eventually, he will have to negotiate. He will have to talk to the TPLF one way or another. And the sooner it comes, that negotiation, the better, because there is no military solution for this problem. It just seems absolutely crazy and a recipe for what might be the breakup of this country called Ethiopia. We are really on the verge of that with what's going on.
Jason, international efforts to resolve the conflict are now accelerating, with countries like France, the US and UK expressing concerns. The African Union has tried to broker talks so far, but they haven't been successful. What potential impact could this conflict have on Ethiopia's neighbours?
Ethiopia is the linchpin of stability in the Horn of Africa region, which is clearly one of the most fragile regions across the whole continent. Sudan, which is undergoing its own fragile transition from an authoritarian regime to something approximating a democracy, has just had to absorb very fast something like 45,000 refugees. Somalia, which is fighting an insurgency by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab, has seen significant numbers of crucial forces provided by Ethiopia to stabilise the country being withdrawn. There are question marks over where this leaves Eritrea, which is known as the North Korea of Africa. It's a very repressive, closed country, but has now ended years of hostility with Ethiopia to become, it appears, a close ally of Abiy Ahmed. That could go in all sorts of different directions. So overall, I think there's a lot of relief around the region that this conflict's first phase, conventional phase, appears to have ended relatively rapidly and without too much fallout. But there's still a great degree of nervousness about what happens next.
Jason, the Ethiopian government is claiming victory. Is this episode anywhere close to being over?
So the question now is, are we going to see some kind of insurgency as the TPLF try to continue the war after losing all the major cities? That depends on the state of their forces. It depends on the state of the leadership. And also, crucially, it depends on the support of the population. The TPLF leadership certainly are talking a good fight. It's very unclear whether they're actually going to be able to fight a good fight. Abiy has said very clearly that what he calls a law enforcement operation will end with the capture of the TPLF leadership. And that is pretty much where we are at the moment.
Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jason Burke. Read his coverage of the fighting in Tigray at theguardian.com, where you can also read Johanna's opinion piece on how this crisis developed. That's all for today. Thank you to Jason, Johanna's and Abdullah for speaking to me. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.